From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. GM's new CEO, Mary Barra, has found herself in hot water in a hurry. Symbol of the new GM, dealing with problems that look mighty old. A company that could not make an acceptable business case, newly revealed documents show, for customer safety. Grilled by Congress this week about a big recall and why it didn't happen sooner before all the devs. This hour On Point, the new GM and its recall mess. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see here? A cover-up? Something more subtle? Do you see a new GM? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we'll look at Tesla Motors and how it's marketing its electric sports car. But first, to Capitol Hill, where brand new GM CEO Mary Barra has been facing a grilling yesterday and today over the ignition switch recall. As she sat down yesterday, it wasn't exactly tea and crumpets. Just get close to the mic and make sure we can hear you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Please put your microphone close to your mouth and make sure it's on. Thank you.
Can you hear me? Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
And straight to the apology from the new GM chief.
My sincere apologies to everyone who has been affected, especially the families and friends who lost their lives or were injured. I am deeply sorry.
And the assertion after everything that's been heard that GM will do the right thing.
Whatever mistakes were made in the past, we will not shirk from our responsibilities now or in the future. Today's GM will do the right thing.
But there's a lot of emotion around this, and there's a death toll waiting to be fully addressed. Outside the Capitol, before Mary Barra's testimony yesterday, Laura Christian, birth mother of Amber Rose, who died at 16 when her Chevy Cobalt crashed into a tree, said GM was to blame for many deaths.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. We are the people left behind when a loved one got into what was supposed to be a safe car, a GM car. A car that GM knew for years was dangerous and defective. Our daughters, sons, sisters, brothers, mothers, fathers, wives, and husbands are gone because they were a cost of doing business, GM's style.
Let's go right to Washington. David Shepardson joins us, Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. He's been watching this entire story unfold this week on Capitol Hill. David Shepardson, thank you very much for being with us. How did Mary Barra do in her first day and in her second day as it's unfolding here? How's it going before these committees?
It's been tough. She's been presented with a lot of very difficult emails from about 7 or 8 years ago that show that GM, looked at the cost of improving the ignition switch and determined that the 90 cents per switch that it would have cost to build a more a safer switch would have only been offset by 10 to 15 cents per switch in warranty savings. So there was not a business case to be made for this. So she repeatedly denounced these prior decisions, but then, dodged a lot of questions because the company has a massive internal investigation totaling some 6 million pages of information. And remember what happened with Toyota. Toyota recently settled a $1.2 billion criminal investigation with the Justice Department after a four-year investigation because, in part, they gave misleading facts to Congress. So GM is very eager not to mislead and, when in doubt, not answering questions.
What is the goal of these congressional hearings? Is this grandstanding? Is this a bigger than normal recall screw up? How does this stack up as a recall problem or cover up, if that's what it was?
Well, we don't know if it was a cover up. Certainly, it's a large recall. Not by no means the largest. The number of deaths linked to this problem, 13, at least 13, is a very sizable number relative to other recalls. I think if the biggest thing that may come out of this is there's a new push for new auto safety legislation similar to the bill that stalled in 2010 after the Toyota hearings. The three main points are a $3 fee on all new car sales to raise money for more auto enforcement, a $200 million maximum penalty for not meeting not recalling vehicles in a timely fashion up from the current $35 million, and giving the government the authority to immediately order unsafe vehicles off the roads. Currently, the government has to go through a cumbersome two-step process with both a preliminary and then a full-scale investigation before they can get to that point where they can demand the cars come off the road.
And what about the regulators? How did they look in yesterday's hearings?
Well, you know, they've got some questions to answer, too. I mean, in 2007, a senior government investigator said he had seen reports of four fatal crashes and asked for a formal investigation to be opened. His superiors rejected that. They say in part it was due to bad timing, since one of these three crashes that the government had opened an individual investigation on, the results came in 2008, which showed that, in fact, it was tied to this this recall, or the airbag defect. But by then, they had already moved on to another issue. So, no, the government has to answer questions, too, about why they didn't find this, and whether it's true that the only reason they didn't find it was that GM didn't provide more information earlier.
Mary Barra looks like the new face of GM, but GM, General Motors, has been talking about a new GM for a long time, haven't they, David, even in the years that this was taking place?
Well, that's a really good point. In fact, remember back in this 2005 timeframe, you know, GM was struggling financially and going through endless rounds of job cuts, plant closures, and as it was moving toward, you know, its near collapse in 2008. So you did have a lot of people under pressure to keep costs down. They were trying to get a new vehicle out on time, this new small car, and it was a company that, as the CEO said, had more of a cost culture than a customer culture. It's certainly easier for them to do today, since GM has about $35 billion in the bank. But certainly they've now learned, like a lot of other companies, the very expensive lesson of perhaps taking a shortcut.
Let's hear just a little bit of an exchange right on this theme. This is Republican Representative Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania asking Mary Barra if the company's culture led to the use of poor quality a part in this case.
Was there a culture in GM at that time that they would have put cost over safety?
Again, we're doing a complete investigation, but I would say in general, we've moved from a cost culture after the bankruptcy to a customer culture.
And so she asserts that was the body language looking like it was buying that yesterday, David?
They really honed in on that question. In fact, a couple members said, okay, tell us exactly what the culture was. Were there any documents? Can you show us what was GM's commitment to safety before the bankruptcy and what is it now? I mean, at one point she said the company's core values have changed and they wanted her to be more specific. You know, it's a very difficult thing to try to explain, these mistakes. And, you know, she's really not getting into much detail besides sort of this broad cost culture problem.
We've got these hearings. We've got GM hiring Ken Feinberg, who dealt with Katrina and Sandy and the Boston Marathon bombings aftermath in dispersing funds. There's also a Department of Justice inquiry here. They've just come after Toyota for $1 billion-plus settlement. Could GM face something like that from the Justice Department?
Well, certainly that's a possibility. And remember, in the Toyota case, the reason they got fined so heavily was not because they made mistakes or had built potentially unsafe vehicles. It was the fact that when this crisis happened for Toyota in August of 2009, the company secretly opted to try to change a part and then canceled that change and didn't put anything in writing, and was just very, was very eager to not share information with regulators. So as a result, the government determined that they had not been forthright with regulators or with Congress, and that's another reason why she is being very cautious about saying anything that later on could be construed as inaccurate, especially as they go through these millions of documents.
David Shepardson, Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. Thank you very much for joining us today, David.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
A little more Mary Barra yesterday in her opening statement before the House Subcommittee.
The facts will be the facts. Once they are in, my leadership team and I will do what is needed to help assure this does not happen again. We will hold ourselves fully accountable.
Going right now to Micheline Maynard, Mickey Maynard, former Detroit bureau chief of the New York Times, contributor to Forbes. Nick Bunkley of Automotive News joins us in just a moment. We just got a minute before the break. Mickey Maynard, we've talked for years about Detroit with you. What do you see now unfolding? Maribara was part of this company during this time. Can she say, I have nothing to do with this?
I don't think she can say that she had nothing to do with it if you just look at senior management and their role in all of this. I'm fascinated by what she said yesterday when she said that she first heard in late December that there might have been a problem with the Chevy Cobalt and that senior management got briefed on it on January 31st when they decided to do a recall. This is so far a $750 million problem for General Motors, including this recall and other recalls, and it's likely to get bigger. And that's not small money in a car company. I'm just fascinated on either the lack of transparency or the lack of communication that's been going on in GM.
Does it mean that the new GM message that we've been hearing for years was not for real?
A lot of us who watched how quickly General Motors went through bankruptcy wondered if it took long enough. They really were only in the bankruptcy courts for a month. They only were owned by the Treasury Department for a couple of years. This is a company that's over 100 years old, and so this new GM period is a blip in its history.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about GM's recall mess and GM's new CEO, Maribara, in the hot seat on Capitol Hill, asking what these recalls say about the way this company has been run. A lot of family members of people who have died in Washington yesterday as these hearings got going. Here outside the Capitol was Jane Reimer, mother of Natasha Weigel, who died at 19 in 2006, crash of a Chevy Cobalt, said she just wanted justice.
There's no amount of money that can replace my daughter, but I do want justice to come out of this, and that's why I'm here.
At the committee hearing, the subcommittee, the question was the cost of customer safety just too high? And you can hear CEO Maribara saying that whole idea is disturbing to her.
So when GM concluded that the tooling cost and price pieces are too high, what does that mean?
I find that statement to be very disturbing. If that was the reason the decision was made, that is unacceptable. That is not the way we do business in today's GM.
Republican Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania questioning her there. But when the committee wanted to get into the details, they heard a lot about GM's internal investigation. Outcome still unclear.
I do not know the answer to that, and that's why we're doing this investigation.
Again,
that's part of the investigation.
I can't answer specific questions at that point in time. That's why we're doing a full and complete
investigation. Will tell us that.
NPR's Morning Edition, putting that little montage together, Maribara pointing to an investigation whose results are yet to come. With us today from Phoenix, Arizona, Micheline Maynard, former Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. She's a now visiting professor in journalism at Arizona State's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication, author of The End of Detroit. And from Detroit, Michigan, Nick Bunkley joins us, enterprise reporter for Automotive News. He's been breaking stories in this whole big story for a while now. Nick Bunkley, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Were they asking the right questions on Capitol Hill yesterday, Nick? Are they getting at the issue, the problem?
Well, they're definitely asking a lot of questions that so far GM has not been able to answer. And I certainly saw a lot of frustration from the members of Congress, the families that were there. They're looking for answers that GM just can't really answer yet. And the longer they can't answer it, unfortunately for GM, the worse this keeps looking for them.
You cover this industry in depth. Is it credible to you that executives at Maribara's level, now when she's at the top and not so long ago when she was near the top, would not have known anything about this until late December or January of this year, Nick?
Well, at one point she referenced the idea that just information was not shared in a lot of cases between different departments at GM. And that was the case in a lot of that previous period, and it may still be the case in some cases now. I mean, again, you know, automakers like this, it takes a while to change their culture. It's not something that just happens, in a 6-week bankruptcy. You know, that things are magically different on the other end. I do believe things are changing and have changed, but. There's certainly evidence throughout here, before and after bankruptcy, that information just wasn't passed along, and by design, they didn't pass along information all the way to the top necessarily each time they were investigating a recall. I think because by law, once you discover that there may be a possible defect or that there is a defect, you have to take action pretty quickly there, or you're in violation of the regulations on them.
Nick, can we go back through what happened here just a little? Because it's interesting. I mean, this is it's just a little part. We've all seen the picture now. It's just that little ignition right there, sort of size of your thumb and all this controversy and consequence around it for many families and now for GM itself. What was wrong with it? When did they know that? What did we learn in the documents revealed yesterday about who knew what? And when it came up for review, the documents seemed to show that you had GM engineers disagreeing over whether or not to fix it.
Yeah, like you said, it's this very tiny part. It's about 2 inches long, black plastic. It doesn't look very notable at all. I've got a couple of them sitting on my desk that one of my colleagues went out to a junkyard and found a couple and took them out of some Saturn ions there. And unfortunately, it's this little tiny part that when it doesn't work right, it can cause a lot of problems. And the issue was just that it wasn't built strong enough, it looks like. And as we see more of these documents and things that were released by the House Committee yesterday and over the weekend, basically this part never worked right. They approved it in 2002, and it was far below the specification that GM had said it needed to be at the time. And then in 2006, this very critical redesign that they did without telling anyone or leaving much of a paper trail, it looks like it still didn't meet specification then. So the idea that they were building this part, this entire time that was apparently defective, the full time that it was being used, definitely raises so many questions that, again, Mary Barra was not able to put many answers to yesterday.
Now, this is really important because you have these internal documents saying there's not it doesn't require enough torque to turn this, which is all about how it can turn off on its own, or if it's bumped with a heavy keychain. That's what leads to all the problems that the case is being made here that led to all these deaths. And you've got an engineer saying, you got some engineers or managers saying, hey, let's just put it in the next year's model. And you got another one quoted here saying, I'm not sure we should do that. I'm not sure it's okay. I want to discuss. And then it's changed, but it's not given a new number, a new part number. You and others have reported that's very unusual, Nick.
That is definitely something really troubling it sort of goes back to the same idea that David Shepherdson talked about earlier, that in Toyota they changed the accelerator pedal. Nobody knew about it. There wasn't any paper trail. In this case, a very similar thing seems to have happened. This part was changed. It appears to have largely fixed the problem anyway, if not entirely. And yet GM itself did not know about that, did not know that its own part had been changed until 7 years later when they got the records from the supplier. After these deaths had all happened, after these crashes had all been reported and nobody could figure out what was going on, clearly some number of people within GM and many of the names that have come up are still employed by GM. Some number of people knew that had happened, but a lot of people just had no idea.
GM didn't know, but that all depends how you define GM. These were GM employees who did know. I mean, from the what was released yesterday, they knew, they were grappling with it. Here's an engineer says, I was very aware of an issue with the inadvertent ignition offs. That sounds like knowing.
Right. There were certainly a number of people that did know, but it wasn't in GM's actual records for some reason. Anyone that started looking into these problems later on didn't find any evidence, apparently, that part had been changed.
And the change was only applied to, obviously, new cars, so they weren't going back for the recall. Your headline is, earlier recall could have averted most deaths.
Right. That change happened in the middle of 2006, and most of the deaths that GM has linked to this recall happened after that point. So, again, if they had done something more at that point, if they had made an actual recall, if they had been more upfront about that part had been changed. It was changed clearly for a reason. And you know, if they had made some larger action by that at that point, there's certainly the possibility that some of those deaths that many of them happened afterward, could have been avoided. I mean,
do you see the possibility?
Obviously hypothetical.
But do you see a possibility of a credible case being made here that constitutes a cover up?
Well, and that's certainly one explanation for that is that somebody was covering something up. When this first started coming out, it looked like sort of a decade and more long trail of just whatever you want to call it, incompetence or just failure to understand what was going on or failure to take the right action. But there have been some of these signs coming out. Just over the last couple of days, we found out who exactly had signed the document that approved that part change back in 2006. And that very same person was in a deposition last year in a court case saying he had absolutely no awareness that part had been changed. He did not authorize any change. And if it was changed without his knowledge. And that's the type of thing that GM is really going to struggle at this point to explain.
I'm not sure it's okay to wait, says this engineer, Lori Queen, in the documents revealed yesterday. I want to discuss, but things rolled forward. Mickey Maynard, you've covered this industry for a long, long time. Here's a 90. The new part would cost about 90 cents. In GM world, in the overall economics of an automobile, is a 90-cent replacement, that might be life-saving, something that gets a no because it's too much money?
Right. So if you look at the document that talks about the 90-cent part, there's an offset that basically says we'll spend 90 cents, but we'll only save 10 to 15 cents in warranty costs.
That's kind of insured costs that will be offset by – it won't come out of their pocket. Is that what that means?
Right. So I just want listeners to understand that I know it sounds like a small amount of money, and it is in a sense, but we're talking about a vehicle family of what's turned out to be two 2.6 million vehicles. So that's essentially a little bit under $2.5 million if you're talking about a dollar or 90 cents for every single one of these vehicles. So car companies, when they do these new vehicle programs, really are looking at every dollar that they spend. And now in retrospect, it sounds like it was the wrong decision to make. However, this is the way that car companies have traditionally looked at these car development programs. Can we save a dollar? A dollar is a lot of money in the car world. 10 cents is a lot of money in the car world. So I'm just trying to explain to your listeners why this is so significant.
But Mayor Barr saying yesterday,
this is how car companies think.
That's how they work. But I mean, if you're the family who paid $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for one of these cars, and now you have a child who's dead, 90 cents sounds like, are you kidding me? You wouldn't spend 90 cents to save?
I was actually thinking, Tom, about something that the former CEO of General Motors, Rick Wagoner, once said. And he said that, we lose money on every car we sell in North America. And this was at the time when SUVs and big pickups were so popular. And he was basically saying, we're losing money on cars. These were the cheapest cars that General Motors made. And so cost was under particular scrutiny on these cars. I'm not saying this to excuse General Motors what they did. I'm just saying to explain the way that General Motors was looking at it at this point in time.
Let's take a call from Charlotte, North Carolina. Blaine is calling. Hi, Blaine. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Fairly well. What do you see?
Well, a couple of things. This reminds me of some movie I saw. I'm not going to say the movie for that, but this is such a no-win situation for the CEO. I mean, I understand what they're doing. They have to go through the hearing. But, I mean, I don't feel sorry for any CEOs or anything like that. But, boy, she is in a really, really tough spot. There's no way she can win on this on any point, no matter what kind of answer she has. I just want to hang up and listen.
Yeah, Blaine, thanks for your call. Nick, she didn't come out right away when this started to break, but she ultimately did. In her first video, she said terrible things happened. Here's Mary Barra, the new face of GM, but not new to GM. She's a lifer there. What about the pickle she's in here, Nick? How do you see it?
Well, right. She's new to this job, and yet she has been at GM a long time. She's been part of the old GM that she now says you know, so many times was broken and did things so wrongly. And yeah, that's just obviously a dilemma in how to explain that away when she is somebody that's been with the company so long. You know, certainly she, you know, she says she didn't know about this until the end of December, and you know, until there's any evidence that she did. I you know, don't see any reason to think that she would have known before then. But again, she is the face of the company, and you know, this is certainly a long way from you know, what kind of image she was giving GM just a couple of months ago. There was so much talk about her and her historic selection as the first female CEO. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was not long ago people were wondering if she was being underpaid as the CEO here when there was some issues with how her salary was being disclosed. I don't hear that argument at this point when she's having to sit there face Congress these couple of days.
Let me bore in with you here. Mickey Maynard says, look, 90 cents or 10 cents is a big deal in car company terms. So what about this? When this was Representative Greg Harper, Mississippi Republican congressman yesterday, he asked Mary Barra, he said, how does cost figure into safety decisions? And she said, they don't. Cost doesn't figure in. She said, if there is a safety issue, if there's a safety defect identified, we go and fix the vehicle, fix the part, fix the system. She said, it's not acceptable to have a cost put on a safety issue. But isn't it absolutely clear from these documents that that's exactly what happened here, Nick? And is it different now in GM policy?
Well, right now it's clear that was a safety issue and that they should not have absolutely put that kind of analysis onto it, as she said. What we've seen in a lot of the documents and the evidence that we have so far is that you know, many of the people that were aware of this seemed to apparently think that this was not a safety issue for a long time. They knew that there were reports of cars stalling, turning off, losing power while they were driving, and you know, again, it's kind of hard to understand, knowing what we know now, how they looked at it that way. But they saw it as you know, hey, you can just pull over, turn the car back on, and you're good to go. For whatever reason, they just did not see the idea that this could potentially cause crashes, could in many of these deaths cause the airbags to not work when the car crashed. There's these depositions of engineers talking about you know, they're testing their car and, you know, making the car turn off on purpose to test it and saying, oh, it can still be controlled. But you know, the problem there
good
is that
luck. You can control it even though it's turned off.
Right. And these are you know, they're trained engineers that are, you know, experts at driving cars. They are expecting the car to turn off, and they're testing it out on, you know, deserted streets at slow speeds. These crashes, you know, they happened on, you know, at much faster speeds, and many of them happen to be young, inexperienced drivers, because that's the kind of people that buy the cheap cars that GM was selling then.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about GM's recall mess and GM's new CEO, Mary Barra, in the hot seat on Capitol Hill. Lots of family members of people who died in these GM cars in Washington this week. One right here telling NPR, it was like a funeral all over again.
This right here is like being at the funeral again, you know. If they would have listened to one or two of us, we wouldn't have all these people out here today.
And there was the call for accountability.
It's just horrific that money is put over human lives, and it's just not right, and they need to be held accountable for it.
New GM CEO Mary Barra, before the subcommittee yesterday, was asked whether GM would take responsibility for the massive recall and the problems that came before.
Is the company responsible?
The
new GM, is it responsible?
The We will make the best decisions for our customers, recognizing that we have legal obligations and responsibilities as well as moral obligations. We are committed to our customers, and we are going to work very hard to do the right thing for our customers.
We'll look at what that means. Nick Bunkley is with us, enterprise reporter for Automotive News. He's been breaking stories around this whole situation. Micheline Maynard is with us, former Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times, joining us today from Arizona State's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. 800-423-8255 is our number. Lots of response online here. Peter says, we know it isn't Mary Barra's fault. Well, she's CEO, though, and the company is now being asked to answer. Mike says, I'll put this to you, Nick and Mickey. Mike says, was there a secret conversation in which GM execs determined how many deaths it takes before admitting a problem? Delphi says it informed GM of a problem in 2002. Mickey Maynard, does that sound absurd to you, that question, or is there some kind of calculus like that that goes on?
I don't think so. These are human beings, too. And even though a lot of people want to see evil in this situation, I think the people running General Motors don't look at it that way. But I absolutely buy the fact that there was a cost discussion that went on about whether you would get enough return, whether it was worth spending the money given what you would save in warranty costs. Now, that does seem logical to me, but I do not think it is discussed in death terms.
But I mean, you wouldn't have a cost conversation, Nick, unless there were some stakes. And surely the stakes are safety. Otherwise, why are you even thinking about it, worrying about it, arguing about it?
Well, again, when they seemed to have this cost discussion, it apparently was framed in a way that they knew there was a problem, but they didn't see it as a safety issue. So they did not, according to the evidence we've seen, seem to think that was, you know, safety that they were comparing using dollars and cents there.
What is the evidence of that? Because you've got Lori Queen, one of the engineers, saying, I'm not sure it's okay to wait in changing this. And of course, you've got the infamous statement, none of the solutions represents an acceptable business case. That seems to be, you could interpret that as having been said, you know, maybe a reasonable safety case, but not a business case here.
Sure. And that email from that you mentioned from Lori Queen, that came out just yesterday, and that is starting to contradict some of the evidence that we had seen prior to that, because we don't really know what happened after that. That email was from I believe September of 2005, and the part was changed in April of 2006, and we don't know what conversations went on after that between those two points, clearly, they did, you know, start to see that there was, you know, some urgency there. Whether again they knew that this was related to deaths, injuries, that we just don't fully know yet.
Stark in Fishersville, Virginia. Stark, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've got another slant to this. I feel that Mary Barra was basically thrown under the bus. She's a very competent person and will probably do a great job, but the senior staff at GM knew they had a problem, knew somebody was going to pay, and the last thing they wanted to see was a white male pay for it. So I thoroughly believe she was thrown under the bus and that probably it was a cover-up.
Stark, let us pick it up. I appreciate your call. Mickey Maynard, how about that? I mean, it did seem to happen quickly. Some have speculated that her predecessor might have wanted to get out of there. Speculation that putting Mary Barra there now, new face, might insulate GM in some way. What do you say, Mickey?
So I'm actually reading this point of view on a number of comment boards that Mary Barra was set up. So what she said yesterday was that, you know, what she had no knowledge. She, to the best of her knowledge, her predecessor Dan Akerson had no knowledge of the situation, and she only heard something fuzzy in December. So that is a good question, and Mr. Akerson has not talked about this, and so I would love to see him maybe come before Congress as well or do an interview and talk about, you know, exactly what he knew and when he knew it, because that's a good question. He The reason given at the time he stepped down as CEO was that there was an illness in the family and he wanted to be able to deal with that. He remains as a consultant to General Motors, and he's also gone back to his old job at the Carlyle Group, the investment group in Washington. So I mean, he's around. It would be interesting to hear what, you know, what he has to say about this.
Nancy in Omaha, Nebraska. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think this is just an example of a larger problem in the capitalistic model where companies such as the oil companies, the banking industry, the auto business put public safety and perhaps the environment and other, you know, things that are less tangible ahead of shareholder value.
Of course, public safety is pretty tangible when it comes into your family, but systemically, you're thinking maybe it leans against thinking about that. Fair enough. We've seen many examples there. You know, capitalism supporters say, yes, but you get innovation on the other side. But there's cost here as well. There's a systemic critique. And let me get even more pointed with that, if I may. Nancy, thank you. David in Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'll try to be pithy, punchy, and on point.
All right.
My father and my two uncles worked more than two decades each for General Motors and B.F. Goodrich. And so we've definitely got a car background, and they were white-collar jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember back during the Firestone debacle, the tire debacle of, I don't know, what was it, 10 or 15 years ago,
yeah.
There was no prosecution, and there's really been no discussion on your program today about what the criminal penalties are that these folks face. But I remember back in that day, my father came to me, we'd been talking about the tire thing. He said, let me ask you a question, David. If your mechanic willingly put on a defective tire on your car and you went out, had a car crash and died, what do you think would happen? I said, he'd probably go to jail. He said, right. And he said, no one's probably going to go to jail from Firestone, and I'll bet you. And it brings in this whole question of corporate personhood, how the corporation's insulated, and how you can buy your way basically out of jail threats.
David, our time is short. Let us pick it up. Nick Bunkley, in the Toyota case, it was $1.2 billion in the Department of Justice saying, hey, this was covered up. That's a big fine, but it wasn't charges against individuals. Does automotive safety law permit that? Could it have in Toyota's case? Could it in GM's?
Well, if the Justice Department looking into this, I mean, there's certainly the possibility that they could go that direction. You know, we don't know. As you said, in Toyota, that's not what happened. Toyota, one of the issues is that you know, some of these decisions were being made in Japan. You know, here, obviously, this is all happening right here in Michigan. You know, the way that this is going, you know, there certainly could be, you know, more evidence that comes out, and you know, if there's proof that that somebody knew this was a safety issue, was connected to deaths, and didn't do anything about it, or didn't tell anyone that they should have. You know, there's definitely, you know, facing some possibility of you know, running into those legal issues.
And Mickey Maynard, when Mary Barra says we have legal obligations and responsibilities as well as moral obligations, do you think she's talking to crash victims or to shareholders?
Well,
or
here's
both?
What's going on, which listeners should understand. General Motors, when it filed for bankruptcy, was basically split into two pieces. And the responsibility, the liability for these recalls actually goes with, before 2009, goes with Motors Holding, which is the old General Motors. And so this new version of General Motors doesn't have legal responsibility for things that happened before 2009. They only have to worry about what happened after 2009. And as Nick pointed out in one of his stories, only one of the 13 deaths occurred after 2009. This actually limits GM's legal liability, but when Mary Barra talks about a moral responsibility, I mean, it's not just a moral responsibility, it's a brand responsibility, it's the future image of General Motors that's at stake here. I mean, it could legally say we don't have to do anything for people before the 2009 bankruptcy, but going forward, if you want to attract customers, especially at this time when, you know, we have all these other choices besides buying cars to get around, you know, General Motors has to think really hard about what it wants to do for the people who were affected before the bankruptcy.
A lot of work to do here to make that new GM case maybe all over again. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us today. Micheline Maynard, with us from Phoenix, Arizona today, author of The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Mickey Maynard, thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And Nick Bunkley, enterprise reporter for Automotive News, joining us from Detroit. Nick, thanks so much.
Glad to be here.
In a moment, Tesla Motors bypass cuts out the auto dealer. This is On Point. Tesla Motors, makers of the luxury electric sports car, has been waging a state-by-state battle to cut out the middleman, the car dealership, and sell directly to customers. Car dealers in New York, New Jersey, and other states are waging battles in legal arenas, legislative and regulatory arenas. Yesterday, Tesla saw a victory in Ohio when the state Senate allowed Tesla to operate three stores in that state. With me now from San Francisco is Corey Johnson, co-anchor and editor-at-large of the daily television news show Bloomberg West and editor-at-large at Bloomberg Radio. Corey Johnson, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
GM's got much bigger issues here, but if there's a new automotive industry in this country, maybe this is a piece of it. And Tesla is trying to change the entire way cars are sold. That's got a big debate going on. What are they trying to do, and what's the pushback, Corey?
Well, it's really out of necessity. Tesla doesn't have a dealership network. They don't have the infrastructure that the automotive industry has and that even new automotive makers such as Saturn, over we've seen over our lifetime, have sort of built up. They're trying to do things in a different way by not giving up that piece of revenue in part so they can say they've got larger revenues by selling the cars directly from the manufacturer through what they call showrooms or really stores directly to the consumer.
Is this running into legal problems in states? Are there laws that say you have to sell a car through dealerships?
You got it. Those are the laws, and they're state-by-state laws. They're different in different states, and it's proved to be a great impediment to Tesla, which has found itself unable to sell cars in very big, important states like Texas, North Carolina, New York, New Jersey, Ohio. They've seen significant limitations in their ability to sell cars there. There's a recent uproar when the auto dealers, franchise owners who have paid a lot of money over the years to be franchises, to be licensed franchises, and to support, for example, repairs in their franchises and as required by certain states, were up in arms about the Tesla dealerships and got the Tesla stores closed in New Jersey. In New York State, we've recently seen Governor Cuomo step in and say, while there are five Tesla stores in the state and they will be allowed to continue to operate, there will be no more unless the law can be rewritten, and the law has not even been introduced.
So what?
Ohio has also limited these. So it's a problem for Tesla, but it does sort of point out that the dealership model and the requirement to have repair facilities available in those dealerships is a state law provided to consumers and keeps anyone from selling cars directly.
I was in a shopping mall not so long ago, and I saw just a glass storefront. Not that big, with just big enough to hold one Tesla sedan. This is their $70,000 four-door, the Model S, just sitting there. Nothing, it's just the car. That's it. Is that what you call a Tesla store?
Indeed, and you probably didn't see somewhere you could get the tires.
I didn't see a wrench inside or an oil drip. No.
Yeah, exactly, and that might be a concern to you if you say, did you decide you might need an oil drip or a wrench? And indeed, that's one of the issues there. And it's also about turf, right? It's also about auto dealers and car makers wanting to protect the market share that they have, and they're using those issues. And you know, you say $70,000, you'd be hard pressed to walk out of there for less than the average cost of a Tesla, which according to Unit Economics last quarter was $108,000.
Okay.
So these are expensive cars.
I'm lowballing it. They delivered 22,477 cars last year out of 15.5 million vehicles sold in the United States. How does Tesla say it would service those 20,000 plus that they sold last year? Sooner or later, they're going to need servicing.
And some indeed have needed servicing real quick. As you may have seen, there have been issues about some of the cars, a couple of cars in the U.S. and another one overseas in Mexico, catching fire. And these are powered by lithium iron batteries. So.
Yeah.
Not every fireman knows that when they approach the scene of a fire. So these fires have been quite dramatic, and so they have agreed to install some additional shielding underneath the cars.
Who does that if they don't have dealerships? Where do repairs get made?
So they do make some of these repairs at some of their locations, but not all of their stores are repair facilities, and that has been an issue for them. It's an experimental car. It's an interesting car. It's a government subsidized car to a great degree. Like I said, the average cost of a car last quarter was well over $100,000, and it's a car for rich dudes, which you know, as a rich dude, I'm all for it, but it's not a car for everyone.
Oh, so you're a rich dude. Congratulations.
I'm trying, yes, thank you.
If car dealerships are the kind of people who tend to know their legislators and have political power, if they succeed in shutting down Tesla's sales model in enough states, do they shut down Tesla?
Well, I think what it really does is it puts a limit on what their potential growth is. I think that what we've seen is that people are generally excited about the idea of Tesla. Not everyone can afford a $108,000 car, but people like the idea of an electric car, and they like the look of this sports car, and they have some interest in it. It's a sedan, it's a four-door, but it's an interesting car. And I think that that will continue to put pressure on legislatures. We certainly saw that in New Jersey, and Tesla themselves are going to draw up as much support as they can. But I think the technological changes that this car represents, the electric drivetrain, we see other car makers imitating. We're going to see cars from Audi and others, sports cars at the same kind of price range that will have these electric batteries, and it'll be interesting to see what their future is. It might be even greater than Tesla's itself.
But still, Tesla has to sell a certain number of cars to work. Does it work if it can't sell out of its storefronts?
They certainly want to sell a lot more than they are right now, and they'll need to survive as an entity.
Is this pushback a kind of way of old Detroit competing through their dealers or trying to shut down a new face of automaking?
I think there's a legitimate concern that some of the dealers have. It's certainly a turf war, but it's also about some people wanting to provide the services that they think their states should get.
We're up against it right there. Corey Johnson with Bloomberg West. Thanks so much, Corey. Thank you. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.